call the docket.
Western Refined York Town Inc. against County of York. John R. Walker, Mr. R. Gregel III, David Hugan, the appellant, Sharon E. Panda, Zachary C. Patrick, Randall D. Green, James E. Barnett, County Attorney, the appellant.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. John Walker here on behalf of Western Refining, appellant in this case. This case relates to the assessment on refinery process equipment at Western's former oil refinery facility in York County, Virginia. The code allows localities to assess taxable machinery and equipment based upon a, quote, percentage or percentages of original cost. And there's no question but that that's how the assessment was prepared in this case. However, the Code and the Constitution of Virginia contain an important caveat. As expressed in Virginia Code Section 3503B, it says the specific method selected must be reasonably expected to determine actual fair market value. This mirrors, of course, the fair market value standard in Article 10, Section 2 of the Virginia Constitution. York County selected a very peculiar method of assessing taxable machinery and equipment, and that was through the application of a static percentage, 25% of original cost, regardless of whether the piece of equipment in question was 1 year old or, as in the case of Western, over 60 years old. And in fact, I walked the commissioner through her process, and she was adamant that that 25% never changes regardless of age, condition, or any other fact or circumstance. She literally takes the reported cost that is on the taxpayer's annual return of taxable property.
How common is this methodology? You say it's unusual, but I got the impression it's actually a fairly common way of doing things.
Well, Justice McCullough, what's in the record, and we're, of course, constrained to the record.
Well, and what I'm referring to is some older cases that actually allude to this method, and so it seems to have been around for a while.
Well, it has never been tested before this court. I can say that. And what I was going to say in response to your question is what's in the record is that the commissioner was asked how she came up with the 25%. And she said, well, there wasn't any study or methodology that was applied. She simply called around to some colleagues at other localities. That sounded like a good percentage.
So in theory, she could have just woken up the next day and said, no, maybe we'll make it 35%.
Yes. This was not done pursuant to ordinance. This was simply the commissioner picked 25% as the number, Justice Kelsey.
So your point then is that when the statute says, of course you use a ratio, how do you do this without using a ratio? But, obviously, use a ratio that has some logical relevance to the conditions of the tools and machinery you're dealing with.
That's our contention precisely, is that the use of the static percentage by itself renders it completely illogical that this could be reasonably expected to determine actual fair market value, because nothing is priced like that, where it is the same value in relation to cost, regardless of age or any other factor.
Or equipment of this nature, which in this instance has been used for more than a half century. What is the length of the depreciation schedule for federal taxation purposes, for example? 10 years, 20 years,
I believe 20 is the max that is allowed under IRS depreciation, Justice Mims. I actually looked that up, but my recollection fails me. But there is no depreciation schedule that would go out 60 years. Under the IRS regulations, even applying the longest possible depreciation schedule, at 60 years you are fully depreciated. I can say that with confidence.
But the problem there is that so many of those cost recovery, accelerated cost recovery programs, really are not valuation programs, truly. They're really policy judgments on helping capitalization of industries through tax rules. So I'm just worried that would be any sort of really a big part of the analysis.
To be sure, Justice Kelsey, if you're talking about the IRS, that's a matter of regulation and legislation and policy. However, what I will say in response to your question is that there were highly competent appraisers called as witnesses in this case. None of them supported the commissioner's methodology. They differed widely in their conclusions, but they were remarkably on all fours with each other in terms of methodology, and that is specifically recognizing some form of depreciation. And in fact, they actually recognized the same forms of depreciation, physical, functional, and economic. Now, we're not contending that the commissioner needed to necessarily employ the same methodology as an appraiser would use. But what we are contending is that the static percentage that never changes no matter what, ipso facto violates 3503B and Article 10, Section 2 of the Constitution. And the last thing I'd like to say on that point before moving on is that if you agree with us on this one assignment of error, then you must reverse this case because this was the sole basis of the trial judge's decision.
May I interrupt you again? What would the end game be, though? Suppose the court were to say, look, you just can't pick a number out of the sky. It's got to have some relationship to the facts of every case, some relationship. But we're not obviously going to pick numbers here. We would send it back on remand. Couldn't the assessor just say, well, great, I'll use the higher number of the county's appraisers?
I would disagree with where you ended up on that one. Let me give you my answer to that question. First of all, one of our other assignments is to attack the admission of the county's appraisal. That's assignment number 3. And if you agree with us on that, then the only evidence of value in the record was our appraisal, and you can enter final judgment pursuant to our appraisal. But even if you don't agree with us on assignment number 3, what you would do is you would remand the case with a holding that the assessment was illegally prepared and thus is entitled to no presumption of correctness. And the trial judge would simply proceed to take evidence of value and set the correct amount of the assessment. And that's the alternative relief that we have prayed for. Let me move on to some of our other assignments in my remaining time. Assignment number 2 is based upon the requirement in section 58.13507 of considering a bona fide appraisal. And in this case, Western submitted an incredibly fulsome appraisal, almost 200 pages long, that was utterly disregarded by the commissioner based upon a feeling on her part that the assessor had employed an improper methodology by, quote, backing into his value. But what she missed was that he employed this only in connection with his sales approach analysis. He employed all three methods of appraisal, sales, income, and cost. And there is an incredibly detailed cost approach analysis in the appraisal that doesn't back into anything. In fact, in my rebuttal examination of Mr. Remshaw, beginning in the appendix at page 1135, I had him walk back through his appraisal and correlate his cost approach methods to that that was testified to by the county's appraisers, Mr. Hornsby and Mr. Watson. Their methodology was identical. Their conclusions, admittedly, varied widely, but their methodologies were identical. Yet the commissioner utterly disregarded Mr. Remshaw's appraisal because she didn't like one of his three appraisal methodologies.
But isn't there a little more to that? I mean, for example, she asked for some documents about the valuation of the underlying real estate, and she said that wasn't provided to her, and evidently she was skeptical of the low value that was attributed in the appraisal. I know, and
sure.
Your expert used another expert to supply that to him, and then same thing with the valuation of the tankage. She wanted to look more into that and what that was worth, and she says it wasn't provided to her. So she was skeptical about the appraisal for those reasons.
Let me say a couple of things on that, Justice McCullough. First of all, those reports were absolutely supplied in discovery like 2 years before trial.
Right, but we're faulting the commissioner versus, so did she have those reports? The commissioner, not circuit court.
At where I was going with this, Justice McCullough, is at trial, she had those reports, and
okay.
She testified it made absolutely no difference in her ultimate conclusion, number one. Number two, the figures that were used by Mr. Remshaw were substantially below the county's own figures. And if you consider the math here where he's doing a residual analysis, by using the lower numbers, that actually increases the value of the M&T. If you were to, for example, utterly reject the work by Stancil and by Mr. Eckert and use the county's numbers on the real estate, you come up with a lower number on the M&T. Third point is we actually identified those exact two reports as trial exhibits at trial, and they were objected to by the county. They had the chance to fully cross-examine Mr. Renshaw about them and never even brought them up. And so, and I guess the last point, Your Honor, I would say that this exact point about, oh, we held back documents was argued extensively before the trial judge. He rejected it at every opportunity, and there has been no cross-error assigned to that ruling. Let me move on to our assignment number four. I do rely on our brief on assignment number three. This has to do with the county approbating and reprobating on the highest and best use of the property between the real estate appeal and the M&T appeal. But I'll rely on our brief on that. Let me move on to our assignment number four, because this presents another statutory interpretation question of first impression before this court. It arises under Section 3503B, and specifically the requirement of considering condition, including but not limited to technological obsolescence. In this case, our appeal very much raises the issue of economic and functional obsolescence, in that, as acknowledged by everybody, even the county's appraiser, the property was operating at a loss at all relevant times. Mr. Hornsby, the county's appraiser...
Well, not for 2010, though, because we're looking at January 1, 2010, and for the preceding year, it operated a profit, right? For all of 2009.
I believe, Justice McCullough, the financials are in the record, of course, and they're going to speak for themselves, but I believe that as of January 1, 2010, the property was operating at a loss. Now, what you would be correct in saying is that the property was, in fact, in operation on January 21, 2010, so that the equipment we're talking about here was actually in use. The property was shut down, the refinery operations were shut down in September of 2010, and in fact, as of January 1, 2011...
I mean, there was a clear downward trajectory to the profit of the refinery, but my understanding of the record was for the year 2009, they still were operating at a profit.
I'm going to have to just rely on the record on that one, Justice McCullough. The pertinent point, though, is that certainly as of January 1, 2011... the property was shut down and not in operation, yet this was given no consideration whatsoever.
Counsel,
I see I'm into my yellow light, Justice Mims.
Real quickly, the time the county makes some argument with regard to the value of the equipment purchased shortly before shutdown. Was that environmental equipment, or was that equipment that was that you had the option to or to not buy?
The recently purchased equipment was all mandated by federal regulation. It was basically pollution control stuff and did not enhance the capability or capacity of the factory in any way.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
All right. Ms. Pandak.
May it please the Court, Sharon Pandak, counsel for York County, and with me is James Barnett, county attorney. I want to start with the first point that Justice McCullough raised, and in fact this case, if you were to strike down use of a percentage, would in fact damage and change the way that M&T taxes are assessed in many places and localities.
But no one's suggesting strike down the use of a percentage. You cannot do your job without a ratio of percentage. The question is not that. The question is, does the ratio have to have some arguable, minimal connection to any facts related to the M&T owned or owned by the taxpayer? And his argument is there's a concession, essentially, through testimony. The assessor said, no, doesn't have any. It's just a broad, we apply it all the time to everybody. That's not just a ratio. That is almost like a law.
Justice Kelsey, that is not an accurate statement of the record that the commissioner does not take into consideration appraisals or other information that is brought to her. Secondly, that percentage is not something she pulled out of thin air. You have a veteran commission here who has served for more than 30 years, in fact, prior to the time that Western actually bought the property. She had also the expert information from Paradigm, Western's accountants, that for the years prior to 2010, ending in 2009, that in fact her methodology equated to the fair value of the property. She said, and she testified, and the judge took note of this, that in fact that her use of the 25% with respect to Western in years 2010 and 2011 was a fair value of the property as a whole.
So,
and so
the
we
taxpayer has characterized unfairly the 25%?
The taxpayer has characterized unfairly that the 25% does not yield something equivalent to fair market value. And you can truth test this, so I wanted to give you a number of references to do that. First, when you look at the Remshaw appraisal, which is the appraisal that Western wants to posit, first, it's a subtraction analysis, and even if you go through the cost analysis, as Mr. Walk has indicated, you will still find that there is an allocated value, and that allocated value is based on the fact that they have allocated specific properties to specific values after doing a total appraisal of the property as a whole, and then subtracting items. So if you look at page 1545 of the joint appendix, you will see that. Also, if
also
you look,
Mr. Walk's brief also points out that there were three different approaches used in the Remshaw appraisal, and that only one of them walks back using the subtraction analysis.
That's correct. I believe he said it on the sales one, and he said that the cost approach, which is the same methodology, the cost approach methodology, the one preferred by the county's experts, does, in Remshaw's case, use a subtraction analysis. If you look at the exhibit that is posited in the record, it shows at exhibit, I believe it's plaintiff's exhibit 2, you will see that, in fact, he uses a residual analysis in which he starts with a number for the property as a whole, containing everything including real estate tax, pollution control, and then he line items out of it. In fact, what happened was...
My question is this. Yes. Conceding that one out of the three uses a methodology that you have done a very good job of discrediting for purposes of this. Two out of the three approaches that his appraiser uses do not use that methodology. Is that correct?
No, sir, that is not correct.
He uses the same
allocation as to determining what the individual units of the machinery and tools value at as he does in the others. He does a subtraction analysis.
And as to the income approach, both experts discounted that given the circumstances the refinery was in to say that just doesn't work for valuation, correct?
Yes, sir, that's correct. And the reason, and you will note also that the income approach makes irrelevant whether or not the refinery was losing money. The issue here is the taxation of the machinery and tools, and in fact, three of the pieces of property bought in recent times equated alone to $213 million, more than the county's assessors, Mr. Hornsby and Mr.
Now,
Watson.
Now, he indicated, though, that those recent purchases were all anti-pollution equipment that was required, that was mandated by federal law.
Your Honor, there's no testimony that was mandated. In fact, it was a choice that was made for them to decide to remain competitive. And whether or not it's mandated or whether or not it's competitive, it still is an addition of value of equipment to that property of $213 million. And as I said before, the income approach, what might be somewhat relevant to this, is rejected by all of the appraisers.
Well, did the 25% ratio take into account the new equipment? Did it look at the median age of all the M&T?
Yes, sir. The 25% took into account that property reported by Western to have been acquired, to be on the site, and it also subtracted from that equipment that property which Western had disposed of.
Right, but I mean, suppose it hadn't purchased the new equipment. None of it was purchased. Would the tax rate still have been 25% on everything else?
It would have been 25% unless the commissioner was convinced by Western that there was an appraisal that would say that
so the new the new equipment wouldn't have changed the 25% to 24% or to 23% or to 28%. It would be irrelevant.
She assessed the equipment at 25% of its value as reported by Western.
My point is, is the 25% in any way tied to the age of the machine and tools in this taxpayer's?
It is not tied directly, but the commissioner said that it was her opinion that the value that was yielded by using the 25% in Western's case equaled a fair valuation of that property.
How can you value tools without taking into account depreciation age timetables? I mean, I don't know. Educate me. I just don't know how that's done.
Your Honor, the statute allows the property to be valued at a percent of original cost. It then allows the taxpayer to bring forth evidence of an appraisal. In the case of 3503, it can be technological obsolescence. In this case, Mr. Remshaw never brought forth in his appraisal evidence of technological obsolescence. For example, in the telecommunications case with the computers, in that case, a wholly different type of personal property were obsolete.
On the taxpayer to make sure the assessor gets the assessment right, or is the burden on the assessor to take into account the relevant variables, including the age and condition of the machine and tools?
This court and the statutes give the commissioner the presumption of the burden of correctness with respect to the assessed value. It is then the burden on the taxpayer, clearly within the tax statutes, 58.13984, I believe, to come forward with evidence that there is manifest error in that assessment. Western failed to do that. And again, they failed to do it because they provided a subtraction analysis. And you can see the obvious subtraction errors because the appraisal that was brought by Remshaw to the commissioner and which the plaintiff originally sued for was that the property was valued at $16 million odd dollars. What he said. When they got to trial for years 2010, they changed that appraisal, Mr. Remshaw did, to $32 million, and for 2011, they changed it to $24 million. Why did they change it? Well, the exhibit shows that the reason why they changed it was other values changed that they were subtracting from the total. Nothing changed about the machinery and tools at all. And so they didn't come in and demonstrate technological obsolescence. They didn't demonstrate that the equipment was not functioning. In fact, on the day that they made the business decision to close that plant, 350 people went home because that plant was fully operating on the day that they made that business decision. That goes, if they want relief, 3507 provides relief in the form of them coming in and declaring the property to be idle.
Counsel, is there no option? Declaring it to be idle means that you are still fully taxed from April 1 of 1 year until January 1, 2 years hence. Is it your position that there is no way for a taxpayer to say that during the intervening 21 months we are able to argue that that the tax is too high? Because we are, in fact, idle?
No, they could argue the tax was too high based on relevant appraisal evidence that would show, in fact, the property was improperly assessed. But as to the idling of it, they get an incredible benefit. It is a huge exemption because they pay no tax.
Your point is there's this percentage default rule authorized by statute that the commissioner, in her experience, has found generally tracks fair market value. And if the taxpayer doesn't like that, he can come in with an appraisal that's persuasive to either the commissioner or the circuit court and knock out this default rule. Is that right?
That's correct. That's exactly the way the statute works. And in this case, Western never did that. And you can, again, as I want to give you examples of how you can tell that they are not accurate. They had loans on that property that were secured by that property of $1.7 billion and $800 million.
Are those loans secured solely by that property, or do those loans have multiple levels of security?
Your Honor, that's an interesting question, and the commissioner asked that of Western, and they never provided that information to her. Mr. Walk says in his brief, well, there's lots of property that's secured by it, but he never breaks it down.
But does that allow you to presume and then come in front of this court and say, well, it must be worth in excess of $1 billion because it secures loans in excess of $1 billion.
No,
I don't see where either one of you gets to argue that point now.
Well, it may be a standoff on it, but it certainly doesn't cut against the assessment being incorrect. A further truth testing of it, in addition to the ones that I have given to you, most tellingly is the paradigm determination. Their accountants said, in fact, the property was as assessed, was close to the valuation and fair, is that when you look at Mr. Hornsby's appraisal, which I would direct you to Joint Appendix 2076, and this was miscited in our brief to the transcript number on pages 14 and 40, but if you look at 2076 and 11798 of the Joint Appendix, you see a reference to what Western was telling the rest of the world. They were clearly telling the rest of the world something else about the value of this property. In an SEC 10-K report, Western announced on March 12, 2010, that the Yorktown Refinery long-lived assets had a carrying value of $725.9 million. Then, the next year, after they shuttered in September of 2010, on March 8, 2011, Western filed an SEC 10-K report in which they showed that the Yorktown refining assets were $472.4 million.
Is that number relative to the tangible personal property on that?
No. Mr. Hornsby's point was that if you added his value that in the real estate case, which Mr. Walk wants to bring up with a very speculative arithmetic calculation, not even his expert uses, if you add that real estate value that Mr. Hornsby had to his value of the property for M&T, you are very close to the value that that Western is reporting to the Securities and Exchange Commission,
but
and also his research
Hornsby,
to the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Didn't Hornsby at the real estate valuation say that the highest and best use was not for a refinery in the future, but rather for a terminal?
That's correct, because for real estate purposes, the highest and best use was a terminal.
But then he turns around in this proceeding and says, no, the highest and best use actually is a terminal. Is a future refinery.
That's correct, which is the same conclusion of highest best use as Mr. Renshaw.
No, I get that, but I'm talking about what Hornsby did. And tell me why that's not just turning and burning and playing fast and loose with evidence.
Well, one, Western never really impeached Mr. Hornsby with that. It is the same
Maybe
highest.
They didn't impeach Mr. Hornsby, but it's in front of us, it's part of the record, and it looks really odd.
Yes, sir, it does. It may look odd, but it doesn't when you analyze the fact and in the context of what Western is telling the rest of the world, that the highest and best use for machinery and tools purposes is an idle refinery.
You've made a good point on that. I want to focus right on Mr. Hornsby and what they call approbating and reprobating.
Yes, sir.
And those are terms that this court doesn't like, and you need to respond directly to that, independent of SEC 10-K filings or anything else.
Yes, sir, and I would like to do that. Hornsby did not use the plain sale in his valuation of the real estate taxes, which is the artificial math that Western does. Your Honor, may I finish?
Yes.
Western did not demonstrate that Hornsby committed any error in finding different highest and best uses for different property assessed under different statutes. He did not cross-examine Mr. Hornsby that he used USPAP improperly. He found no statute or standard that Mr. Hornsby violated. He failed to even confront Mr. Hornsby at all. So what you have here are valuations of two different types of property. And the only thing that makes it sound a little screwy is the artificial math which Mr. Walk and Western constructed in this on the M&T case to say, oh, well, if you use the sale price, of planes at $180 million, and you subtracted out this real estate valuation that Mr. Hornsby did, then you end up with $15 or $16 million, and that's got to be the value of the M&T. Mr. Hornsby said that, in fact, in his view, the sales agreement with planes didn't even address M&T. And if you want to do artificial math, and you subtracted out the value that Western settled for the real estate taxes, which was substantially less than Mr. Hornsby's valuation, then you get to an M&T valuation of $103 million, which is not very far off. In fact, it's higher than the commissioner's assessment of the property.
Has she answered your question? Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Pandak. Mr. Walk.
Thank you. Let me respond to a couple of the questions that you asked Ms. Pandak. But before I do, Justice McCullough, you stumped me on one earlier. I have your answer now. If you look in the appendix at page 1478, this is a page out of Mr. Remshaw's appraisal report where he sets forth a spreadsheet of operating results year by year. And the last year in which we reported an operating profit was 2005. The property was losing money in cascading fashion from 06 forward. So I wanted to be sure and come back and answer your question since you stumped me on that earlier. Justice Kelsey, in response to your question to Ms. Pandak about the 25% and how it is tied to value, I want to specifically cite to pages 10, 14 through 22 of the joint appendix. This was my cross-examination of the commissioner where I specifically walked through with her. Now, if a piece of property is 1 year old, what percentage is it applied? 25%. How about 10 years old? 25%. How about 60 years old? 25%. There is absolutely no correlation between age and the percentage applied, and the commissioner abundantly conceded that at these pages of the transcript.
Counsel, but what the county says is that you didn't present any evidence of the condition of the property other than age. Can you address?
Well, we presented two things. A 200-page appraisal in which there is detailed discussion of physical, functional, and economic obsolescence. So we certainly presented that both at the administrative appeal stage and at trial, as well as Mr. Remshaw's testimony. But even more to the point, just to crystallize it with like just one little fact, our appeal at the administrative level for 2011 was based rather strongly on one issue, and that is the place is shut down. It is not in operation. That is the acknowledged fact, the commissioner knowledge of it at all times, because this was a pretty newsworthy event locally, and yet gave it absolutely no consideration. What they have argued in their brief, Justice McClanahan, is that somehow this 25% evens out when you apply it across a broad enough population. So if you take all the taxpayers and all the property in the county and average it all out, it comes out to about 25%. Well, I can't really affirm or refute that assertion except to say this. My client has their own constitutional rights. The fact that this might average out over some broader population is irrelevant. I see I am out of time. I apologize for going over.
Quite all right.
Pray for reversal.
You were answering a justice's question, which you were entitled to do.
Thank you.
Call the next case.